Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
In center ring today, we have Sarah Armstrong. Sarah is author of The Mom's Guide to a Good Divorce, and it is a really good guide. Sarah's background, though, is not in family law. Sarah wrote the book because she's been divorced and has some great guidance to give people. But what Sarah does professionally is she's vice president of global marketing operations at Google and proud mom of Grace, who just graduated from high school, right?
She did. She just graduated and heading off to college in just a couple weeks.
So I think you did a really great job, Sarah. She's not missing a beat. She's moving on.
We're very excited. Her wings are ready to fly.
So I want to start by doing something that literally warmed my heart. It's on the very last page of the book. I want to read this to our audience. I thought this was the best testimony anybody could have about whether they had a good divorce or not. And here it goes. The title of the page is Mother's Day Card, and this is from your former husband. You write, "After 5 years of being divorced, I received a Mother's Day card from my ex-husband that said, it occurred to me as we were sitting together at our first middle school meeting in the library that I am so fortunate that you parent the way you do. And we are almost always in complete agreement and alignment about how we raise our daughter. Thank you for being such a great mom and a dependable, steady figure in her life. Hope you enjoyed your Mother's Day." I mean, I'm tearing up as I say this, Sarah. How did you react when you got this?
Well, Judith, I'm glad you read that. I didn't.
You're tearing up now, aren't you?
Yeah, I have a hard time getting through reading that out loud because it was a testament of a long road we had both been on to get to that point. But I'm proud that we're there and we've continued that sentiment in the last 6 years because we've now been divorced 11 years. It felt rewarding. It felt just right for Grace that we were able to do that together and that he could express those feelings, and I agreed with what he wrote. I feel very proud of how we both have co-parented her.
So you feel the same way about him?
Yes. Yes.
This is excellent. Do you feel super lucky that even though I am sure it was emotionally devastating, even when people see things coming, it's emotionally devastating, right? It's a game changer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I always say that no one gets married to get divorced, right? First of all. And no one gets divorced for positive reasons. And then when children are involved, they don't get to make the decision that their parents are getting divorced, but their lives are significantly impacted by that decision. And so, yeah, regardless of what led you to the divorce and the reasons behind it, you really have to stop and think, what do you want to do about the children you brought into this world, and how do you want to raise them together as parents, as co-parents in this instance? And it has to be a very conscious thought process.
When you first started the journey out of the marriage, was it in any way rocky? Did you and your former husband have to find what your middle ground was, or was it seamless?
No, absolutely. I think everyone has to find what their middle ground is once you start living in two separate households and trying to work together on raising children under two different roofs. And so there's definitely rocky moments, and there's moments where you're trying to figure out how to do this together in a healthy way that your child is not negatively impacted by your interactions or your decisions or whatever the case, the dynamics you might have between the two of you. And so, yes, we definitely had some bumps in the road and things we had to discuss and figure out how do we do this? How do we make this so that Grace isn't the one that walks away negatively impacted by the decision we made about our lives that does then impact her life?
What was the communication like prior to divorce? Was it difficult? Was it easy? Did you have to work on communication in the transition?
We're both relatively communicative as individuals, but I'd say communication leading up to the divorce is hard because I think it's very emotional at that stage. And so it's just, how do you communicate about these details that you have to think through during a divorce? And I think after, actually, we kind of got into a groove and a little bit of a structured way of interacting with each other. So, for example, I kept a running list on my phone of the topics that I might want to talk to my ex-husband about. And then I would, you know, ping him and say, hey, could we have a quick call? I just want to run through these points with you. I didn't feel the need that I needed to text him every minute that thought popped into my head, because then we're constantly interacting with each other. And I didn't think that that's necessarily what either of us were looking to do. So we kind of found our way in terms of what was the right approach for us to communicate post-divorce.
Excellent. Yeah. That impressed me. And I was happy you wrote about it, because we don't really know at the onset of a divorce what we really should do, what's the best way to communicate. And there are people that tend to just speak top of mind constantly as things come on. And maybe I'm making an incorrect generalization. I kind of don't think I am. This is a little gender specific. Women seem to be a little more communicative than men. And I tell people when we're in mediations, remember you're talking to a man. Men like to bottom line things, and they would like to just maybe group something so that every single day, couple times a day, they're not dealing with the divorce, even though it may be running in your head every day. What do you think about that?
I completely agree. I think that, you know, there's actually, interestingly, a muscle I talk about that you have to build in
the
life.
The compartmentalization muscle. Yes.
Yes, it's one of my favorite concepts, because I actually think this is a prime example of that, where you need to figure out when it is appropriate and is going to work for you to have those conversations. And when it's not, then to compartmentalize them and put them aside and build that compartmentalization muscle that allows you to decide when you want to engage in conversations with your ex-spouse, or in, you know, there might be things you need to discuss that could have a debate with them, but you have to be in the right emotional mindset to go into those conversations. And if you're not, then it's best to step back and say, you know, right now is not a good time for me to try to have that conversation. And so there is, again, a lot of conscious thought and really discussions you have to have with yourself before you have them with anyone else, in terms of how you want to engage with your ex-spouse.
Well said, because even outside of divorce, we have to assess timing. Timing is everything, right? Whether it's in our workplace, with our parents, even with our kids. Absolutely. Timing is everything. And I think people are just on such high emotional alert, at least at the inception of the divorce process, that they have to learn by experience, timing is everything, yes?
Absolutely. Timing is everything, and figuring out what are those topics that really you need to talk to now, and, you know, that they have some potential timely nature to them, and others that you might say, you know what, I need to discuss that with my ex-spouse, but that can wait. You know, that is not a topic I have to really tackle now. And so really just being thoughtful about what you need to get clarity, and really it's a clarity about how you're running your children's lives together. You know, and what are those? So I always say, what are the discussions you need to have and the decisions you need to make that keep your children's best interest in mind?
And speaking of that, I don't know if you looked at what you wrote the way I looked at something that you wrote, but the phrase best interest of the child, and you said it a couple times here, and it's in every court in the country, best interest of the child, right? Mm-hmm. And so it sounds fabulous, not quite doable in concept if you're going through your own pain. Because unless you're out of your own pain, you can't even understand what best interest of your children are. Correct? Or what do you think?
I agree. But I think even if that's the case, you know, when you two as a couple have decided to no longer be married, you know, you still made a commitment to your children when you brought them into this world to bring them into the healthiest environment possible. You know, I always say we cover the plugs and we put bike helmets on them and we feed them organic milk. You know, we do all these things to keep them healthy and happy and wanting to make sure that they're safe. And then when a divorce comes into your life and into your children's lives, the toxicity that can come with that divorce, and it can have a long-term impact on your children in terms of their approach to relationships, to their view on marriage, and their overall happiness in life. And so I actually think we have a responsibility to take co-parenting seriously from the outset and have that intent of the best interest of your children in your head at all times. Because if we leave them in that toxic environment, Judith, it has such a negative impact for so long. And it's not good for them and it's not healthy. And the outcome, unfortunately, is not a positive thing long-term for those individuals that have sat in those toxic environments.
And if we look at the statistics, 50% of first marriages end in divorce, 60% of second, and 70% of third marriages end in divorce. So there are a lot of people who are children of divorce, and then they want to get married. And their model is what they learned from their parents' first, second, or third marriage.
And yeah, and that's actually why I feel so strongly about the concept of a good divorce, because the perception in society is a bitter divorce, right? There's not enough conversation around the topic of how to have a good divorce, you know? And so my goal is that we could change the social norm of bitter divorces and their lasting impact on children and actually shift societal perception that a good divorce is actually an attainable outcome.
Now, here's what I read. It's on page 219. The title of that is Lead by Example. And as I was reading it, I thought, maybe this is another way of looking at best interest of the child, because I think most parents think they're doing it right, you know, but they're just not there because, again, their own pain is forefront. And so when you were writing about lead by example, I thought maybe this is a more tangible concept to be able to put the best interest of the child in front, because we can look at ourselves and look at what we're showing as an example that's a little bit more tangible. Is that kind of what was in your mind a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to self-reflect a lot, Judith, and look in the mirror a little bit and have a conversation with yourself of how am I doing? And honestly, the answer can be I'm not doing well, right? Like this is one of the most emotional things you can go through in your life. So it's okay to not be okay. The question is, what are you showing to your children? Because sometimes they're not at an age where they can understand or comprehend the emotions you're feeling, and then that causes more confusion and challenges for them. So I felt, and it goes back to the theme of compartmentalization muscle. I felt that, you know, what Grace needed to see is two parents, at least what I could control on my side, a parent that loved her and was trying to create the most positive environment possible, even though we were going through challenging times. And there were tough days, there's no question. But I felt like showing her that life goes on, you know, that you move forward, you don't dwell on the past. And, you know, I think that's another big challenge with divorced families is that I made a promise to myself that this is a bit ironic since I wrote a book on the topic, but I made a promise to myself that I would not let my divorce define me or define our lives. Because I felt that then when Grace gets to the age she is now and beyond, when people ask her about her childhood, I didn't want the first thing for her to think of was, well, my parents were divorced. And I don't think that that's how she would answer it at this point. There is a lot more positivity in her childhood and her life. And I think that wouldn't be the first thing that she would answer if she's reflecting back on her childhood.
I agree with you too. I don't remember if you said it exactly this way, but I know you talked about it in the book. And there's a two-part process that we go through, everybody that is getting divorced. There's the emotional divorce, And then there's the legal divorce. And if you don't go through the emotional divorce first, the legal divorce is going to be a living nightmare. Did you go through an emotional process before the legal process started? Did you have that time?
I did. I did have that time. And so by the time the legal process was upon us, I was mentally prepared for that portion of it. And so actually our legal process was fairly short because we had worked through a lot of our thought process before we actually triggered it. So yeah, the emotional piece was worked through fairly significantly before we actually decided to make the change.
And you had what is called a collaborative divorce, correct?
Yes.
Would you please explain, at least you're on the East Coast, so yeah, what okay. that looked like on the East Coast. I know what it looks like here, and it may be the exact same thing.
So I have to say I'm a big advocate for the concept of a collaborative divorce, and it really means that each of us had basically a coach that would think through the decisions that we collectively needed to make, but from our perspective. We then had each had a lawyer, but the really two interesting other players in the mix is we had a financial neutral advisor who saw all of our finances collectively between the two of us, and then a child specialist that was all about what's the best thing for Grace. And they work as a team. And so the coaches, we would meet, each of us would each meet with the coaches individually, and then they would meet and talk, and then the four of us would meet. And then really the meeting with the lawyers was at the very end, once we had worked through all of the decisions that we needed in the parenting plan relative to.
Oh my gosh. What you're just describing is spending the least amount of money, but appropriately so, on the lawyers.
Absolutely. Yeah. People say that sounds like a lot of people, it would be expensive. It was a much more efficient process from a cost standpoint than it would, I think, a traditional divorce would normally be. And so because you're forcing the conversations up front that, quite honestly, lawyers are not looking to have with couples on a lot of the details that they just want to make sure are clear. But so you work through a lot of the details. And we basically planned out, we had to make decisions about Grace's life up until this year and through college. So we planned 11 to 15 years out. She was 7 when we got divorced. And so, but everything from, you know, decisions about her schooling and decisions about, you know, if we were to buy a car, would we buy a used car or a new car? Who would pay for insurance? I mean, lots of details. But so that then at the point that those decisions in life came up, we had already discussed them. So we didn't need to discuss them as divorced spouses 10 and 12 years later. We could talk about it at that point. And we could always revisit it. But I have to tell you, our parenting plan and the decisions we made back, you know, when we went through a divorce, allowed us to have a very healthy life with Grace, where we had kind of discussed things and those milestones in life came up. We're like, okay, well, we've kind of discussed that. And we went on and we followed what we had agreed to.
You said that your coaches talk to one another?
Yes.
Now, I have not heard of that. All right. So, I mean, I know coaches. I know what they do. Are coaches in the contracts that you each signed with your coaches, was there a privilege? Is there a privilege between both of you? I know there's privilege between attorneys and their clients and mediators and their clients. Mm-hmm. But was it set up logistically that the coaches would confer?
From what I remember, and again, this is going back in time, is that it was so that they could agree on the topics that we would be talking about as when the four get together. Like the point, if there were any sticking points, you know, that they could basically then facilitate the conversation in an efficient way, you know. And so if there were points that it looked like we both agreed, it's like, well, we don't have to discuss that. Let's move to this point, which might require some discussion and potentially some debate. So it was about really planning, being planful about the conversation that we were going to have when the four of us would get into a room so that we could, you know, use that time efficiently.
And then the financial neutral. It's such a good idea. Talk about the job of that person.
So the financial neutral is the advisor is really meant to say, look at the full equation of your financial picture, and then talk about for where you are and what you were both bringing to both the the earnings and then how you're going to potentially divvy them up moving forward, what would that look like? And so it is meant to be a very transparent process and allow everything to be on the table. And they really give you the recommendation of this appears to be the fairest way to divide your assets and to move forward financially.
What I found interesting when we initially met and did our pre-interview just to establish what we were going to present today, you've had very high-powered careers. I mean, culminating in Vice President Global Marketing of Google. And so when you told me that he really handled the household finances, you had zero understanding of what it took to run the household. You had to play catch up. I was surprised and impressed that even in this two-income household, where I assume he's as good an earner as you, that there was still that division of duties. And you had to play a little catch up on what it took to budget.
Yes. Yeah. So I will say first, I entered our marriage never ever contemplating the concept of divorce, as I mentioned earlier. And so when we started our life together, we kind of divvied up responsibilities and I took certain things and Mike's husband took certain things. And, you know, he's like, I'll handle the finances. And I said, great. That works for me. So now in doing that, because we were so busy and we were, again, a double income household, we were raising Grace, you know, things get busy. And I just didn't spend a ton of time digging into the details. And it wasn't until I went through the divorce that I realized how little I knew of kind of the inner workings of our financial situation. And also just, you know, some fundamentals, and these are basics and I'm embarrassed to say it, but it's the reality. You know, I had not focused on how we were even, like when we started out together, we opened credit cards, but my ex-husband's name was the primary name on those credit cards. I was secondary. So my credit, as I was getting divorced at almost age 39, 40, was not established to the degree that you would think because of some of those dynamics. And these are things, again, I had never stopped to ask, never even thought about, really, because I was in this relationship that was meant to be for forever. And so those are moments, and I can say very honestly, it was a moment where I said, okay, Sarah, this is an education point for you in life. It's later than it probably should be. And so I do share with any young woman that I meet to share, you know, please always be astute on your finances and be plugged into them, you know, and just the learnings I've had through this process. So it was a learning. I have caught up. I feel much more savvy, Judith, I'm proud to say, 11 years later, but it was a reality of our situation because of how we had, in a very appropriate way, we were just kind of divvying things up. It was not, but it turned out that that probably wasn't the best decision for me.
Well, it was a great decision while you were in the marriage, and I wanted to bring that out because a lot of women have so much fear over what it looks like financially on the other side of marriage. And I don't want them to feel that they are alone and that even somebody like you, who had enormously responsible, high-powered, net worth jobs, still in a married situation does the normal thing. You take care of this, I'll take care of that. And then we have to catch up, you know, both spouses have to catch up on the things that weren't under their purview.
Exactly. And so there were things that I handled that my ex-husband had never touched. So we both had, to your point, catch up to play in terms of running our respective households. And I do think that the education process we both went through gave us, interestingly enough, probably a healthy dose of respect for what each of us were doing. That, you know, you somewhat take for granted in a marriage as you get into the day in and day out of running a house and running a child's life and all that comes with, again, the financial side and the social side and, you know, everything in between. So it is an interesting thing to reflect on. But I guess my learning is I would handle that aspect of my life differently if I were to roll back to age 25 when I got married.
Well, what would you do differently, Sarah, looking back?
Looking back, I would have stayed more plugged in to how things were being managed. And even actually, it's interesting. I have one of my parents' friends, my mom and I talked about this after the birth. One of my parents' friends, they actually sat down together on a Sunday and paid bills together so that they could both kind of see what was going on. Now, I don't know if we would, you know, ever go to that length, but there would be a different model that I would want to do if I were to ever be in that situation again as a young couple, if I were to roll back the clock. And even at this stage of my life, I am now very much, independent relative to my financial situation. And I am have a deep understanding of all of that now, which I clearly didn't, but because I had the opportunity to share that responsibility, and now that's not something that I choose to do.
That's really sage advice, because in other situations, like tax returns, that is a standard experience in which one person will take everything to the accountant and then, "Here, honey, just sign." And of course, I'll just sign. But when you're transitioning out of the marriage, perhaps just signing is not to your advantage if you didn't read and if you are somehow indebted and you had no idea. And it comes with the tax return. It comes with the condition of the mortgage and the house. Do you have a second and a third and you had no idea? Now it's time to divide the house. Oh my God. Once we pay off the first, second, and third, there's nothing left.
Yes,
I mean, these are shocking things.
Yeah, they're shocking things, and those are realities. And I've unfortunately had friends who have had scenarios that you've just articulated happen in their own divorces. And it can be both a shock at the time of the divorce, but it actually has a long-term shock in terms of what that means for both of you in terms of your long-term financial health. So yes, everything you just shared, I've unfortunately had friends that have had scenarios, and I'm sure you've seen many of those. And so yes, I think at the end of the day, just staying as close to understanding the financial details of your life would be my headline. And you don't necessarily have to manage every detail, but be aware and understand where everything is.
I'm going to throw in credit card debt as one last thought, because that is probably one of the most revealing issues when you're filling out what we call the disclosure forms. You know, you have to fill out about assets and debts. Any state, it really doesn't matter. And then you each produce a financial statement. And the reality of how money was handled really comes out on the debt page. You know, how much in debt are you? And I've seen people in debt to the point where child support wasn't possible unless bankruptcy was declared, because they just, even making the minimum payments, there was no money left. And the other person had no idea.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I've had friends in those instances as well, where the house was running up as much credit card debt because they thought, let's spend it now. And yes, I've unfortunately seen those scenarios as well.
And then you're looking at what is called the piggyback effect on this, is you're looking at what your standard of living was, and everybody wants to maintain the same standard of living. Okay, not going to happen. Two households are more expensive than one. But if you are over leveraged in debt, you really were living a false reality.
Absolutely.
And now that's a big change. Talk about the emotional divorce. Now you have to go back into the emotional divorce before you continue on the legal.
Yes.
Okay. I want to explain to people how valuable I think your book is before I go into some unusual things you talked about that I don't really see in other books, and I read constantly. But you thought this out before you wrote the book, and that is, it's completely easy to read. You have, I don't know, 100 topics. You have so many different topics, and not one of them takes up more than a page and a half. It is separate topics, maybe half a page, one page, a page and a half, so people can wrap their heads around it as a little encyclopedia. Could you go through why you wrote it this way?
No, first of all, thank you for highlighting that. It's really an important part of the story of this book. So when I started writing the book, I reflected back on my own divorce, and I had been given many books during my divorce, and they were all thick and dense, and I would open them and I would close them. And I literally did not read a book during my divorce that would help me. And so when I got to the point of deciding to write this book, which is its own story into itself, but I decided that I wanted to serve it up in bite-sized pieces. So by, you know, topic by topic. And so when you are going through a divorce, there's so many things coming at you from so many different angles, and you can only take so much in. So I thought, why don't I just share bite-sized pieces that you can read one topic, and if that's all you can handle that day, That's all you need to read. And let yourself reflect on that topic. And then when you're ready for the next topic, you can go into the book. It's also written, so there are 185 topics in the book.
And close.
Yeah, you're close. And it is, the table of contents allows you, if you just want to go in, it's set up for preparing for the change, during the change, and post the change. And I built it in those three sections because it's actually not a book that I think you would read cover to cover in one sitting, because you need to take in what you need at the time. And so I wanted to make sure that it was structured in a way where you could understand where you didn't need to go to that next phase until you're ready for the next phase. And interestingly, when I was working with my editor and laying out the book, to your point, I only wanted to put a topic per page because I thought the white space allowed people to think and reflect as well. And it was funny, she said, but you're wasting paper. I said, it's okay, I'll do other things environmentally friendly, but I'd like to keep the white space so that people can only have to look at that topic on that page. I didn't want to double up and have multiple topics reflected. So it's just basically, if you want to turn the page, then you can go from there.
That was so intuitive. I mean, the white space piece. Yes, I completely agree with you that even when I, who I'm quite done with the divorce, but in the divorce business, want to read people's books, they are intense. It is a lot. And it takes me a while to get through it. But with your book, first of all, I always like to read people's books before I interview them. But I really looked forward to coming home each night or getting up in the morning over coffee and indulging, because it was so easy to do.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think this is going to be quite an advantage. I'm sure you've heard from readers that it was an advantage.
I have. I actually had, it's interesting, when I first released the book, I was walking through Whole Foods and I had this young woman approach me in the produce section. And she said, are you Sarah Armstrong, the author? And I thought, oh, and I had to stop for a minute because actually, ironically, again, a part of the story of my book, I don't consider myself a writer. And I had to stop and say yes. And she said, well, I was at your book signing at Barnes & Noble. And she said, and I just want to thank you for writing this book. I'm going through divorce and I carry it with me because it keeps me calm. And she said, thank you for writing this book. And I said, well, thank you for sharing that with me, because you're exactly why I wrote this book, is to help other women that are trying to figure out how to navigate this really challenging life. And so she walked away, Judith, and I stood there in the middle of, you know, the produce section. I thought, that's exactly why I wrote this book, is that woman who I don't know at all, that I can help her through this really, really challenging life.
And it kept her calm.
Yeah.
So cool. All right. Now, let me talk about some of the things that I don't often read in other books that I thought was wonderful. And that is the symbolism of jewelry. I mean, this is one of many, but would you talk about that? I loved what you said about it.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because, you know, I think when you get married and you put whatever sentiment you have decided to showcase that you are married on your hand, I had my, you know, wedding ring and my engagement ring. And, you know, I thought as I was getting divorced, what am I going to do with these? And so I decided that I would actually take the wedding ring, and I've set it aside to sometime give that to Grace down the road as something that she could wear if she chose to. But the engagement ring was a solitary diamond, and I decided to go to a jewelry designer and take the diamond and say, you know what, I want to turn this into a necklace. And I actually want to still wear it because it is still a special aspect of my life, but from a different angle. And so we designed the necklace, and I still wear it to this day. And it's funny, I get tons of compliments on it. And I always laugh and share with people. I say, it's actually my engagement ring repurposed after my divorce. And everyone always smiles when I said, so it's still a beautiful piece of jewelry. I've just, you know, created it and made it my own.
And that goes hand in hand with cherish the memories of the past. I love that you said, just because you're transitioning out of divorce doesn't mean you don't have excellent memories, right?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things I think with divorce, you know, divorce can feel like you have a scarlet letter, you know, and that like everything is horrible. And I'm like, you know, that hopefully, and again, certain marriages, it's going to depend, but there are positive memories that you want to hold on to and that you actually want to even reflect on with your children and talk about openly. And so, you know, my memories with my ex-husband, there's many positives, and Grace and I will come up and we'll talk about it. And, you know, so I think that there are definitely things that are important to cherish and to, reflect on, because I think that shows your children again that the past isn't negative. Like there are positive things that we can reflect on. And so I really feel it's important to talk about those openly. And again, naturally, not in a forced manner, but in a way that, you know, just allows you to reflect on the happy times.
And the rough times are there for growth and learning and should never be admonished or pushed aside because they're too painful. Because if you use them as growth experiences, then no time has been wasted.
Absolutely. No, and I would agree. I mean, I think that, you know, I think I was meant to be married to my ex-husband, and I think I was supposed to have Grace, and I think I was supposed to go through this divorce and have a different phase of life that wasn't meant to be, you know, with my ex-husband. And I, you know, there is growth in that. I've grown a lot in the last 11 years, immensely. And I am, I'm proud of the growth, actually, of what has transpired the last 11 years. And I'm proud of Grace's growth in this. And, you know, my ex-husband's, I think, grown in his own right. So, you know, at the end of the day, I would like to think that we're all in a better place post-divorce.
I know you are, just from listening to you and reading. Photographs, you know, these are things that until you confront them, you don't think about, but when you confront them, you're really at a crossroads. And you were talking about the choices in keeping her father's photographs and her father's family photographs around. How did you redistribute those?
That's a great question. It's an interesting story. So there's two parts to this. One is that in Grace's room, we have a wall of photographs of all of our family and with her. And so post-divorce, that stayed. And I'm like, this is Grace's room. And so there's pictures of her grandparents, her aunt and uncle, her dad, you know, that's Grace's room. And so those are all still there. Now in our main hallway, I have a long hallway of black and white photos that were a mix of my ex-husband and my family from generations, actually. And so what I did decide to do there is when Grace was, again, she was 7 when we got divorced. So I decided to make it a project for myself. And I had other black and white photos that I was going to replace in the frames where my ex-husband's photos were. And so I sent Grace down the street for a play date with a friend, and it was on a Saturday. And so she left, and I literally had already put the frames together. And so I took them, the photos that were from my ex-husband, I took his off the wall. I put some new photos up, and I went into the kitchen. And an hour or so later, Grace came home, and I'm in the kitchen. She goes, "Hey, mommy." And I go, "What's that, Grace?" She said, "The wall has changed." And Judith, I stopped in my tracks. I thought, oh my gosh, how did she notice that? And I go, "Well, what's changed?" She goes, "Well, there's more pictures of me up there. It looks great." And she ran up the stairs up to her room. And I just took this deep breath and I thought, oh my gosh, because it could have been, well, there, you know, all of Daddy's pictures are down, but that wasn't what she noticed, again, at age 7. But why I share that story is in divorce, when a house is pulled apart, which genuinely is unfortunately the case in many instances. If I had not taken the time to maybe replace those pictures and just taken the pictures of my ex-husband and taken them off the wall, put them in a box, given it to him, and left those little hangers up there, you know, waiting for the mm-hmm. me to around to putting other pictures up. Right. What Grayson's memory would be years later would be my parents got divorced and my mom took all the photos of my dad off the wall and those little hangers were there.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want that to be her memory. And so it was, again, it took effort. And, you know, with everything going on in divorce, it's like, do you have time to deal with black and white photos? But I thought these were these small, but I think really important signals of not wanting to pull her world apart, not wanting there to be the memory of the hanger on the wall. And so those are the types of things that I think, if you can think about those specific scenarios in your own household and in your own children's life, I do think it makes a difference in their long-term perception of what happened during the divorce.
You just hit on something that therapists talk about all the time, especially therapists who work with children. And they advise when they're speaking about, you know, do everything in the best interest of the child, make sure your child doesn't think that the divorce is their fault. And I would ask at the beginning of my time in family law, well, why would a child think that they're the cause? And the answer was always the same from every therapist, because their world revolves around them. All they can see is from their point of view out. So if you don't make sure that your child knows this has nothing to do with them, mommy and daddy totally love you, we'll always be a family. If you don't make sure, everything reflects back on them. And so this is just really an interesting case in point you just brought up, that her reaction was, there's more pictures of me.
Absolutely.
Again, this is how children look at the world. It's reflective of them.
Yes. And so, and it was a very appropriate, age appropriate reflection for her, to your point. And, you know, but from where I was standing, you know, still in the kitchen as I heard her say that, I thought, you know, this, I mean, it could have been a different reflection. It wasn't. I was so thankful, Judith. But you're right. It is about their world and how they're reflecting on what's happening in their world.
Something else you talked about that I loved, and at least women fear this. I don't know if men fear this as much as women, but it's being alone socially. And when you are a parent, your friends are couples of other children, because school is your common denominator. You will be alone in some cases. You will show up on your own in couple events. What was that like for you, and how did you move through this difference in the social dynamic?
Great question. This was probably one of the more surprising aspects for me post-divorce, and I will say, because my pre-divorce social life was all couples. And as it would be, and I did lots with my girlfriends too. But our weekend evenings were always couples going out to dinner, doing certain all sorts of fun things together. And so when I got divorced, what I found is that I still would do things with a couple, but be invited to their home. And again, these are my wonderful good friends. But the invitations to go out with other couples and me as an individual stopped completely. Completely stopped. And I wrote about that in my book, and some of my friends, in fairness, had never heard me say anything about it, but it is a reality, and it's still, even to this day, that has not changed. It is just a part of when you are divorced and you're that fifth or seventh wheel on a two or three couple outing. Those invitations don't come. But what I have come to appreciate is that's okay. First of all, I do really appreciate my own alone time. I reflect on that as a gift. Secondly, I've changed, you know, how I manage my social interactions. You know, I do go out with couples, you know, myself with another couple, and I do a lot of one-on-one dinners with my girlfriends and other things. But that social dynamic was very surprising to me at the time. And I had to really wrap my head around it. And now I've just adjusted and shifted how I approach my social life, but it was probably one of the bigger surprises I hadn't really even thought about. And it did surprise me.
Marriage is the connection between couples. I mean, that's your one connection, is marriage. When that connection leaves for one person in the group, there's no way to balance out, I don't think, this one person who used to be part of a couple in this particular social dynamic. There's no really way to balance it. And I was so glad when you wrote that there was no animosity. It was just, okay, I didn't think about it, but I get it. And it's okay. And there's another way to still connect with at least the women in those couples that were your really good friends, regardless of marriage being the connective tissue.
Yes. And I don't hold it at all against any of my friends that that's the dynamic. It is. It's just kind of a reality. So there was nothing, I just kind of had to mentally wrap my head around it and think about, okay, if this is the reality, then how do I want to manage my social life, because I am a social individual. I love spending time with people. So I just had to adjust. Yeah.
The other part of this is, and it's not expected at all, and it just hits you like a brick wall, and that is the couples will start, not some will choose sides, but some won't even know how to communicate. And all of a sudden they will just, out of a lack of understanding, not communicate.
Yes.
They won't be present. How did that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I say in the book, I talk about that friends will take sides even when you don't ask them to. Because, you know, in my instance, my ex-husband and I were not asking friends to take one side or the other. But it just naturally happens. And again, I had to reflect on that and say, that's okay. That's just the natural norm, I guess, within the divorce world of people trying to figure out how to maneuver. Because even for friends and family, it's a very hard thing to figure out what do we do in these instances. So that happened with us as well. But it's been fine. And we although I'd say we have certain friends that we tried to stay connected to on the from each other's worlds.
There is there's a chapter, a 1.5-page chapter, titled Embrace the New Normal. And I just want to read a second. This is also the potential that part of the new normal is a new family tradition. And you're talking about reorganizing how you handle special occasions, I think, as an example. A friend shared that they get together as a family on their wedding anniversary to celebrate the anniversary of their family, not of their marriage. But there could be other things that would trigger a getting together of ex-husband, ex-wife, and children just to celebrate something interesting. I'd like you to address that for a second, and then I want to read from the very last sentence that I also thought was important. But how did that work for your family? What do you celebrate together?
Yeah, so we still, throughout all of Grace's life, we celebrated her birthday. Mm-hmm. So my ex-husband would come, and we would have a family dinner. We've celebrated all the special moments in Grace's life together, and her graduation recently, we were all together. So I think we have tried to, again, when it's about Grace, really say that that's the focus, is she should have both of her parents, you know, helping, singing happy birthday to her when she's blowing her birthday candles as a little girl, and even up to age 18. So I think that was how we approached it. But, you know, every family is going to have to figure out what are those moments where it may be unique to your situation, but it doesn't have to. I always say no one else has to judge. It's only for you as a family to decide what makes sense to you. You know, I have divorced friends who've literally gone on African safari together with their kids. I mean, you know, there's lots of things that you can do with your, I mean, my ex-husband and I are moving Grace into college in 2 weeks together. Like, we'll both be there. We're going to, you know, get her all settled in. And I think that's what you need to do when you're parents.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's really good to make the child that connection, because it is. You may not be living as a married couple, but you're always connected as a family through your children. That will never end. All right. So that's cool. But then there are some other things that you kind of have to let go of that were traditions because they don't make as much sense. And this is what I wanted to read from at the very end of this particular chapter, Embrace the New Normal, and you said, a friend of mine shared this quote with me after the divorce, and it really resonated with me. Quote, you don't realize the weight of what you have been carrying until you realize the weight of its release. I took that to mean, don't be afraid to let things go if it makes more sense. Is that one of the things that your friend meant? And is there something else?
Yes. Yeah, no, it was absolutely that. That I think, again, if you look at I talk about societal norms a lot, but I do think they play a lot into how we structure our thoughts about whether life is normal or not. And I think, you know, allowing the fact that your holidays are going to be different, your ways of, you know, interacting as a family may be different, and just saying that's okay. It's okay that it's going to be different. And letting go of the expectations, letting go of what I talk about, the glossy picture that we want to create, especially in this world of social media. You know, I think it's really important to say, you know what, that's not how this aspect of our life is going to be anymore, and that's okay. And let that go. Let it not be something that you're worrying about.
I'm going to use an older reference, and that is the Norman Rockwell painting of the traditional family doesn't have to be exactly the same now.
Right.
There can be a reorganization of the family, and it can be just as good as where you came from.
Absolutely. And, you know, when Grace and I were on our first spring break after the divorce, we were at the beach, and there was a family next to us at a table, and it was a mother and a father and a son and a daughter. And she looked and she goes, well, that's a real family. And I had to stop and I said, Grace, what do you mean? She goes, well, there's a mommy and a daddy and a brother and a sister. I mean, that's a real family. She's like, we're not a real family. And I said, oh, and I said, Grace, we are a real family. And I had to explain to her, when I came back and talked to her child specialist, this was really early on in the divorce, and she was seeing him. He told me, he goes, you shouldn't have told Grace she was wrong, because that's her perception and that's her reality right now. She will learn over the course of time that families come in many different shapes and forms. But at that stage, that's the model that she had in her head of what a family looked like. And so it was interesting. And so because I wanted to jump to explain very quickly. And he said, you know, in that instance, it may have been better just acknowledge it and say, Grace, that is one form of a family, and just not maybe tell her she was wrong.
I can't imagine in a million years how anybody wouldn't have wanted to answer like you. I mean, really.
It was hard. I wanted to defend, like, it's going to be okay.
Well, and also to make her feel that you really, I mean, everything you said was so positive and so supportive of her. And I can imagine that was shattering for a second with all the effort that you put into it, that she would say that. Yeah. And she and just from reading this, it seemed like she was always fine.
It was. It was just one of those points of reflection where she just, it was just like a, you know, like that looks like a normal, you know, that looks like a real family. It was, yeah. Again, early on, I think if you were to ask her today, there's no question she would say, and throughout our lives together, that, you know, our family is a family. It's unique in its own right in terms of structure, but it's still a family.
You know, I interviewed an attorney, Christopher Melcher, recently for the Celebrity Divorce series that I do. And we talked about custody in regards to how it played out for Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, and what custody means to, you know, everyone else, and how it can be abused, misused, or used properly. But he said one really funny thing, and he said, in the modern era, when so many people get divorced, I can imagine in the playground, kids saying, talking about the visitation schedule, well, I've got a 225, and I've got a 323, and I've got, I mean, who thinks about this now? But I'm wondering if this actually happens when kids are by themselves and talking about their family. Did you ever run into this with Grace at all?
It's interesting because I think, you know, Grace was one of the first of her friends to be part of a divorce situation. She was in first grade when we got divorced. And over the course of time, other families around us started going through this process. And two things. One is she reflected because of how we'd approached ours. She's like, Mom, it doesn't need to be that way, when she saw a negative divorce. But then, which is really interesting. And I do have to say, she was the one that coined the term good divorce for me. And I don't know if I shared that with you.
No.
She went, again, at age, a year after our divorce, we were in the CVS picking up something. And ironically, we were looking at a People magazine that had a celebrity divorce on the cover. And she looked at me and she said, Mommy, is that a good divorce or a bad divorce? And I thought, Grace, I don't know. What's the difference between a good divorce and a bad divorce? She goes, well, a good divorce is when the mommy and daddy are nice to each other and get along like you and daddy. And a bad divorce is when they scream and fight.
Another place where I would cry.
Yeah. And Judith, I walked out with her and I thought, wow, I said, we're only a year into this, but whatever we're doing is working.
Yeah.
And so that's why over the years, as Grace has reflected on other divorces she's seen around us, and to your point about comparing notes, they do compare notes. And Grace has really said, I try to help my friends say, you know, well, hopefully your parents can do X, Y, or Z. And a lot of times that may be not the case, but she could see that we had taken a very specific approach to how we've managed our divorce, and hopefully for the positive for her life. And I think she's been able to share that with others. But you're right. I think it is a reality, and kids do compare notes.
A conversation that is more contemporary than we think. Absolutely. There are two other things I wanted to talk about that I thought were important for this conversation. One of them is, you said that focus on helping others, volunteering helps you minimize your own pain. I thought that was important. I'll tell you why. First of all, everybody's in pain. I had a very easy divorce and I was in pain for a year. Everybody's in pain. And I remember a friend of mine years ago, who was one of the smartest people I've ever met. She tragically lost her 2-year-old son. And I mean, any parent knows, I mean, how do you get over this, right? The way she got over it was that she volunteered to help others. She got outside of herself. And I was so impressed when I saw that. How did you think about that?
Well, part of it was, I feel, you know, we were very fortunate in our lives. And I wanted to be able to both give back, but also teach Grace about giving back. And so what I tried to do at a really young age, and actually we started right after the divorce, is she and I would go and serve at a soup kitchen together. And she was so young, she couldn't, and she basically was, you know, right by my side the whole time. But we did that for the last 11 years together. And every Sunday that we would do that, we served in that soup kitchen here, that it's the longest serving soup kitchen in the city. And every time we do that, Grace and I would talk about both how fortunate we are. And you could see, for both of us, it puts everything in perspective in a heartbeat when you're helping others. And so I just feel it's a big part of our lives is figuring out how to give back. And I think even when you're going through a divorce, having something like that to go and do really puts everything in perspective. You can be debating, you know, who's getting what silverware or china or piece of art or whatever it is. And you go and you see other people that might be struggling with very basic needs in life. And you think, what are we debating? What are we fighting over? And so I just felt like it's an important piece. It's always something I think is kind of a touchstone of keeping grounded in what's really important and the kind of essentials of life.
Yeah, I was so happy to see that. Lastly, and this is huge, bringing significant others into your life. And, you know, I will never forget that scene in Jerry Maguire when Renee Zellweger had her child. Mm-hmm. And so she's starting to date Tom Cruise, Jerry Maguire. Her whole philosophy was, I will not bring anybody home to meet my son unless it looks like it can be a long-term relationship. I'm not going to have a revolving door. From start to finish, this is, to me, one of the biggest issues. I want to start with, at the onset of a divorce, what is your philosophy about having relationships at all with somebody else? This is a tough one.
It's a tough one. Yeah. So I think everyone's at a different stage when they come out of divorce of what they're looking for, you know.
Or even going into it. I mean, people literally start other relationships while they're filing.
Yeah. So that's why I say you can be at different points in your relationship or need for a relationship. And so I think giving yourself a little space, because the first year post-divorce, I say that you have a divorce hangover, literally.
Oh, that's right. You did say that.
And I mean, you need to recover from that hangover before you can be at all, I think, someone that you would want to engage with other people. So I think giving yourself some time and some space and figuring out what you want how you want your life to be lived with your children and your ex-spouse, and just kind of getting that sorted. Now, I see people do a range of things, Judith. Some jump right in, some wait. I personally waited. I didn't get into a relationship about a year and a half after our divorce. But I think it's such a personal thing in terms of where people are in that emotional journey of recovering from the divorce and from being open to another relationship. But I would personally say giving yourself some time just gives the space for both you and your children to figure out what life looks like post-divorce before you are introducing someone else into the mix that then also has to be sorted out with how you're already still kind of sorting out, you know, your kind of new family dynamics. So that would be, and again, if I were giving coaching to someone, I'd say pause and wait a little while before introducing new people into the mix would be recommended.
How about with her dad? How long did he wait, or what was his experience like?
He had a relationship fairly quickly afterwards, but he didn't introduce Grace to her until probably about 10 months in, 8-10 months in. So gave some space to Grace to kind of get used to things. And they're still together, 11 years later, so she's been a part of Grace's life. And so I think that worked for him as well. We didn't really specifically talk about what period of time it needed to be. I just think we both were saying, and to your point, that it would need to be someone who's going to be meaningful and, you know, in Grace's life for the long term, and the concept of a revolving door was not something either of us were looking to have her be exposed to.
Organically, a few years ago in my mediations, people started bringing up on their own, can we put into our divorce settlement agreement in the custody, the section about the children, that we will each wait at least 6 months, at least until we're 6 months into what we think is going to be a committed relationship. This just naturally happened. It's not a law. So I just left it in that section for other couples to see how they would react. And I said, this is arbitrary. This came from other couples, not from me, because it just seems to be a consciousness now that's evolving among people getting divorced. I thought it was important because here's what I've seen. And I know you didn't see it with your daughter, but maybe you've seen it with your other friends and can comment, and that is children need time to reattach to their parents individually. So they're having, so let's just say the communication is great. You know, parents have good communication. Okay, that's wonderful. But still, there are two households, and there are all these ramifications for the kids that come out of two households. Am I going to forget stuff at the one house? I'm going to this house. What about the homework? You know, there's all these logistical kid things that come up. And then if one parent or both parents are bringing their significant others to the initial months of the co-parenting schedule, you're not giving your kids the time and the opportunity to reestablish their individual relationships. And as a mom, how important do you think this is?
I think it's extremely important because I think you are reestablishing what that new normal in your house and in your ex-spouse's house looks like, and reconnecting in a different way. I mean, the dinner table is different when there's just the two of you and Grace is an only child versus the three of us, or if dad's seat is empty. And if someone else is sitting in dad's seat, that can be, if it's too soon, it can be really confusing, especially to younger children that are not understanding, wait, what just happened? So I think being very cautious about how quickly you do introduce people into the day-to-day of a household is important. and is kind of fundamental to making sure, you know, you can get that new normal established in the way that you want to. And what you said, Judith, a quick thing that you said that is one of the probably biggest topics that I want parents with children to think about is when we were getting a divorce and we sat down with the child specialist, he looked at me and he said, "Do you travel?" And I said, "Yeah, I travel internationally for my job." And he looked at my ex-husband, he said, "Do you travel?" And he said, "Yeah, I travel domestically." And he said, "Well, Grace is about to become a professional traveler. She's going to travel every week for the next 11 years until she goes off to school." And I burst into tears. This is right before we were about to tell Grace that we were getting a divorce. And I thought,
traveling between homes, right?
Yeah. And the concept of a professional traveler and that she was going to, quote unquote, pack a bag every week. And I thought, and it just, it like hit me so hard. And so I said, I don't want that for her. So one of the things we try to do, and to your point about day-to-day logistics, is really think about what can we do to ease that feeling of being a professional traveler every week. And so it was a conscious and took some effort. And in fairness, I know there's socioeconomic considerations as well, but we tried to have the basics at both homes. Yes. So Grace did not have to pack a bag every week. And the only thing back and forth with her was her backpack with her school
stuff. With her homework. Yeah. And her iPad or whatever. Yeah. You know, just to finish this point, I remember a dad came to me, a couple came to me, and they had two young children, I think 6 and 8 at the onset, and they went through two levels. They did a legal separation first, and then they filed for a divorce about a year or so later, and it was an emotional soft landing, as well as keeping the wife on the health insurance plan, because in California, if you file for legal separation as opposed to divorce, that's the one aspect that's very advantageous. The spouse who may not be able to afford health insurance that has been the recipient still gets to be. And then that was the deal. A year after we're finally, you know, legally separated, then we'll file for divorce. So when he came back in to file for divorce, I said, "Well, how are your children doing?" And he said, "Not well." And I said, "Oh no, why?" He said, "Well, they're not adjusting well. So the girlfriend I had during the separation still is my girlfriend, and she moved in and she has her own child, but they're upset that they can't have their own alone time with me." And he said, "But I think that's unfair. Don't my feelings count too?" And I may have been indelicate when I immediately said, "No, your feelings don't count. The only feelings that count right now are your kids. You can separately go out and have a relationship. Nobody's telling you that you can't have an emotional relationship. Your kids are telling you they need alone time with you." And kids do. They will tell you they need alone time. You have to believe them.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. That's even when you're married. They want alone time with their parents, right?
Never thought about it that way.
Want their time with mom, or they want their time with dad. And so then if you transition into divorce, they really do need that connection time. So I completely agree with you. And sometimes it is hard when you're trying to juggle all aspects of life of how you carve out that time. But it is really important to figure out what that looks like for your children, because they are really needing that time, especially early on post-divorce, to reset and to reestablish that, you know, that we're there for them, that as parents we're still there, that part, even though we're in different households, we're still there.
And that they are first in your lives. Kids need to be first in your lives. Kids see the world through their own perspective. Grace said, "There are more pictures of me on the wall."
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And they need that.
We need that, and they deserve it. When we decided to become parents, we made that commitment to them. I really feel it's a commitment that is a lifelong commitment. Yeah. But in divorce, there's a consciousness of your decisions, of what that looks like, that is really important to think about and reflect on as you're engaging with your children, because it also has so many other ramifications of how they're perceiving all this change that's going on in their life.
Yes, and if they don't get what they need from you, they're going to get it somewhere else, and it may not be healthy. And so just, you know, think about that. Sarah, we could go on for so long. I feel like I simply scratched the surface of this 185 points you make in your book. So would you please explain to people where they can buy the book?
Yes, absolutely. So The Mom's Guide to a Good Divorce is available on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble. It is available as both a paperback, as an ebook, and also I went into the studio this last year and created an audio version. So it's Audible.
Excellent.
Because I did realize that, you know, you may not want this book sitting on your bedside table. Have it, you know, something that you listen to on a walk. And it's because of the bite-sized pieces. Again, you could listen to a couple on a walk and set it aside.
And on the walk, you can listen to something and turn it off. And as you're walking, think about it.
Absolutely.
Okay, perfect.
Yes. Available in all those formats, and hopefully it's helpful. I feel very strongly that it is possible to have a good divorce, and it's an attainable outcome, but it does take effort. It's not necessarily an easy thing to do, but it is so worthwhile for your children.
I know you're extremely busy, and I didn't ask this before when we talked, but do you have a blog, or do you have a way that you field questions from readers?
Great question. Yeah, so I do have a website, gooddivorce.guide. It has some
gooddivorce.guide. I thought that was a mistake when I first read the dot guide. I didn't know there was another.
Yeah, it's a new way to have a website. So yes, I have gooddivorce.guide, and you can contact me there, and I'm happy to interact. I have people that have linked into me and send me notes on Facebook, but quite honestly, just sending me an email there is fine, and I'm happy to interact. And there's also, you know, ways to kind of reflect on the various topics from the book on the website as well.
Excellent. Sarah, thank you so much. I really appreciated this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me, and always here if you want to talk further.
Okay, absolutely. I'm going to take you up on it. And thank all of you for listening. As always, I appreciate each and every one of you, because I feel that the information we provide on this podcast is so beneficial to everybody in some measure. Please share this with your friends. Please subscribe. You can reach me through my website, theamicabledivorceexpert.com, theamicabledivorceexpert.com. And as always, have an amicable day.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.